4 today, Phantom.
Boy, it's the first time I ever flew one of these. We're live in the cockpit of an F-4 Phantom jet.
Dr. Bell, mission control. Am I doing okay?
Yeah.
Boy, this puppy's fast.
Well, that's how we're starting out the show. Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Squeaky Science and Energy Show today. We're in the flight simulator on an F-4 jet. Boy, that was a lot of fun. Well, welcome to the live taped live show, February 9th, 2007. Going to have a great show for you today. We also want to thank Wesley Snipes, who spent a day down here with us and did 4 lovely BBS radio show recordings. We really needed those. So we've got some amazing listeners out there now. So today we're going to start out the show with where we left off last week on our special educational thing. I'm thinking Dr. Bell's going to be coming in here any minute. I'm looking for him to see if I can get him to come up here. Coming up, Dr. Bell. Where are you? You'll be talking in a minute.
Yes. There is convincing evidence of field responses in some animal species. Certain birds are responsive to the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field, and in the case of some fish, electric fields are used for the detection of prey, navigation, and communication. This report is a review of existing scientific literature on the effects of electric and magnetic fields from 0 to about 300 hertz, which spans the frequencies at which the electrical power is generated, transmitted, and used. Now, skipping a paragraph, it says, second, the subject of the effects of low-frequency fields have recently attracted attention because of the possibility of deleterious effects on humans and lower life forms. The major source of environmental exposure is the electrical industry. In addition, interest and research are being generated by the Navy's proposed Project Sanguin, more recently known as Seafarer, a system designed to permit communications with submerged nuclear submarines. The long wavelength at which the Sanguin transmitter will operate, 4,000 to 7,000 kilometers, and we talked about that earlier in wavelength, requires a large buried antenna leading to the concerning ecological effects on a considerable land surface influenced by the antenna currents and fields. In 1968, the Navy sponsored a review of extremely low-frequency ELF research, which disclosed such a paucity of relevant research that the Navy undertook its own program of studies. Beginning in 1970, the research has been performed in government and university laboratories and on-site of the Sanguin Test Facility in Wisconsin. Read from a footnote, because I want you to do your own research with this book on your own. State of New York Public Service Commission, PSC, case numbers 26529, 26559, concern applications by the Power Authority of the State of New York, which is PASNY, Rochester Gas and Electric Corporation, and the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation to construct and operate a 765,000-volt transmission lines. Cases 26758 and 26462 concern an application by the Long Island Lighting Company to construct and operate 345,000-volt lines. In the 7,665 kV case, the PSC is conducting generic rulemaking hearings beginning in the winter of 1975. The intervention by the New York State Department of Health, Department of Agriculture and Markets, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Attorney General is on the basis of the issues of noise and ozone production, as well as electrostatic, electromagnetic, and other induced effects of 765 kV lines in the relationship of all of the foregoing living organisms, including any possible effects on human beings. In the Lilico case, the towns of Huntington and Islip in Suffolk County intervened against the proposed line, which would be constructed on existing narrow right-of-way passing through populated areas. This is a very serious thing. Now you begin to see where I'm coming from. That's why I say it's important to sleep inside of a pyramid. These studies have been done by bona fide government agencies, and I'm going to quote some of the things in a minute. That's why we make these star orb, which stops negative energy fields in the human body. That's why we have the nuclear receptor to wear on your body to help reduce the effects on these bodies. Okay, I'm going to quote some interesting things. Page 5-34. Fisher, Electric, 1973. Effects on immunological ability. The electric fields in the range of 2,400 volts were found to have a beneficial effect on mice as measured by their activity rate and liver respiration, the ability to form antibodies. In contrast, mice which were deprived of any electrostatic fields by being enclosed in a Faraday cage showed opposite results. This research was designed to investigate the importance of ambient electrostatic field to human health and contains the suggestion that immunological preparedness could be increased by increasing the field as a clinical practice. That's what there are some frequencies that are good for the body. Effects on ATP metabolism. In the Soviet Union, there has been some experimentation at frequencies that are somewhat above the ELF range. Two such experiments which demonstrate biological changes are discussed below on the basis of the English language abstracts on the Russian work. In the first experiment at 7 kilohertz, a pulse electromagnetic field demonstrated that morphological changes in rat liver were correlated with and preceded by a change in metabolism. Up to 15 exposures over a six-month period at unspecified field strength disrupted the liver cell metabolism so that ATP content was decreased, with a concurrent increase in the associated compounds ADP and AMP, which normally are phosphorylated into ATP in the course of cell metabolism. A decline in the synthesis of urea and other biological changes is also reported. What this means is that by decreasing the ATP, you will drop the body's ability to discharge energy from the Krebs cycle, and this will cause a gradual weakening. So this is when you're around a power line and you get weak. A lot of people say, I get weak around the power line. It's very, very true. It's very, very, very popular. On page 612, referencing Asanova and Rakov in 1966, it gives a couple of curves on the previous page of electrical fields going on. And what it says is that medical examinations of subjects exposed as above, and it shows these fields and frequencies, disclosed neural pathology in 28 subjects. The disorders occurred while the person was in the field and disappeared quickly after they had left the field. Subjective complaints were headache, sleepiness, slugginess after work, sexual weakness developing after 8 to 10 months of work in the substation because of long-term generic dangers, work, electric fields, palpitations, chest pain, irritability, and poor appetite. And finally over here, this is Weaver, 1967, 1968, 1974. Effects on biological circadian rhythms. Many body functions, temperature, hormone levels, alertness, vary periodically throughout the day, with a period of about 24 hours by the means of which organisms, including man, maintain a regularity is not yet understood. Recently, this is a nice thing we know, this is what the extraterrestrials were teaching us how to understand. Recently, the hypothesis is that the circadian clock results from interactions between organism and electromagnetic environment having been given increasing attention. The circadian rhythms of human subjects were investigated during the long-term exposures to an external electrical field of 2.5 volts per meter at a 10 hertz square wave. Experiments lasting 3 to 4 weeks in an isolated chamber involved two factors: the influence of natural electromagnetic fields determined by the comparison of subjects in the shielded and non-shielded rooms, and the effect of an artificial electric field, 10 hertz, introduced into the shielded room. The investigator measured the times of waking, sleeping, degree of activity, motion, body temperatures, and electrolyte activity by urinalysis and administered several tests. The subjects exhibited no perception of the applied field, but the field did have the effect of shortening the circadian period by 1 hour after 9 days of continuous exposure to the field. And now what happens is when you shorten the circadian rhythm, you shorten the normal biological response time to reproduce cells in the body. Therefore, what this means is that by exposing yourself to the fields, you're shortening the life process because the cell does not have enough time to go through a complete mitosis period, which in the case of all the blood cells in the body are 90 days. So therefore, you get an incomplete set of genetic instructions themselves, which causes a gradual destruction of the body. A statistical correlation was found between admissions to a psychiatric hospital and changes in the geomagnetic field. This is still off of page 618, by the way. Data were gathered from 7 hospitals in the same area over a period of 4 years and correlated to with the geomagnetic field data taken by the Coast and Geodetic Survey. The authors comment upon the well-known fact that correlation does not imply casual relationships and conclude with their impressions that, in view of the diversity of the two variables under investigation and the grossness of the measures, the present investigations after correlations offer correlations of surprising magnitude, meaning that even though they had a short amount of data in, they got surprising results. In another place, there is a reference to experiments of animals indicating higher cancer induction for mice in grounded cages as to compared with mice in cages insulated from ground. And then it goes into dowsing. Experiments on the phenomenon of dowsing imply links between this curious human activity and the presence of geomagnetic anomalies. One thinks of the dowser holding a fork rod walking over land to determine where the underground water is. However, the dowsing phenomenon is not limited to the determination of water, nor does it seem to require a special rod. The dowsing reaction expressed as a turning of the extended forearms can occur under diverse circumstances when the arms are extended with or without a rod. Trump, in 1968, remarks, it's a book, "It is doubtful whether as much investigation have bestowed on any other subject with the lack of positive evidence for the reality of the observed fact. If substantiated, dowsing is related to our interest in the perception of magnetic fields. Experiments which demonstrate the psychological changes which occur within the dowser enters the dowsing zone show marked changes in skin potential and in the DC level of the electrocardiogram. Using soil resistivity as a measure of subsoil geological discontinuities, Trump demonstrates that the dowsing zones correlate with geologic discontinuities indicated by regions of lowered soil resistivity. His laboratory experiments found that some dowsers could sense magnetic field gradients lower than 0.1 gauss per meter." And some of the references in this particular chapter would be Beischer, D.E., 1965, Biomagnetics. Academy of Sciences, number 134, 154. Brown, F.A., 1972, The Clock's Timing Biological Rhythms, American Scientific, Volume 60-756.
Seminar series is continued on the other side.
Well, now we're flying the space shuttle here, so I will go ahead and put in the other, the next side of this. And like I recommend, highly recommend this Eisenberg book. He's quite a guy. And we're getting the next one on here now. We're going to have some fun. And we will load in 7B. And Saturday night's going to be a lot of fun, too. Always a surprise. So we're waiting for Dr. Bell to kick. Here comes Dr. Bell some more.
Koenig, H.L., 1974, Behavioral Changes in Human Subjects Associated with ELF Electric Fields in ELF and VLF Electromagnetic Field Effects, M. Persinger Edition, Plenum, page 81. And I could go on and on and on. There's so many references in this book to major scientific publications. So now you begin to see why the nuclear receptor is so important. And as we get later on into our entire systems to change the vibratory frequency of your entire house and the areas around your house and work, you're going to see more and more why this is so important to understand and to work with these devices, because they're given to us to use by our friendly extraterrestrial friends. Realize, on the other hand, the negative extraterrestrials, the grays, are fully aware of all of this and are putting out negative generations all of the time. So you must understand these things. That's why our seminars are ongoing and are gaining popularity more and more each day. before we get into the patient part and we start getting into the interdimensional analysis, I want to take a step back again and paint another picture here, because what I like to do in my presentations, even on audio, is to kind of go back and forth, so that you can understand and really get a feeling, a working feeling. Because the one thing about extraterrestrial sciences is not just the mental aspect of it, as we're taught in our terrestrial science things. People evaluate everything from a mental standpoint. It's got to be part of a feeling, too. It has to become second nature. What I want to do is give a brief background history as the basic function of the origin of our great planet Earth. The Earth is part of a great cycle, with changes occurring in the skies, the ground, and the great... Man, of course, out of ignorance, has interfered with natural laws of planetary and universal change, and his interference now poses a major threat to the existence of life itself, of all the domains of the nature, mineral, vegetable, human, and animal. Just imagine that we're flying in a 747 across from one continent to another. Cabin. Pressure, we're flying at, say, 30,000 feet. Cabin pressure, cabin environment. Comfortable, lift. Somebody suddenly lit up a cigar. Somebody lit up a cigar up in the other room. Somebody decided to do some paint removing. Some spilled paint, let's say, on a seat. For instance, the whole environment inside the airplane is so bad, you can't think clearly, you can't sleep, you can't meditate, because you're fighting all these odors and fumes. Exactly what's happening. Now let's look at the Earth as it is now. The Earth contains an inner core, down in the center, an outer core, a lower mantle, an upper mantle, and a basalt crust, which is proportionally compared to the interior layers. The Earth's outer layer is mostly granite on the land and sediment under the seas. I look at it as a cell on a macrocosmic level. The skin of the Earth, or the crust, is thin and delicate, just as our skin is thin and delicate. Similarly, when its surface is punctured, it too, like ourselves, is subject to infection. And I realize that the Pleiadians, a lot of these other races, don't mine their home planets. They mine asteroids. We've already mined our home planet. We've done a lot of damage to it because of greed. If it's the surface wound condition, the white blood cells, leukocytes, combat infection when the body is healthy and balanced, so the infection threat stops at the outset. The Earth, too, has a natural defense mechanism, but we are slowly hindering these and setting ourselves up for total racial annihilation. Think about the hydrogen and atomic bombs, how nice those are. By now, it should be evident that even the most minute electrical changes can cause a change in the world's situation in time. And we talked about the cell, you know, being the organism being the aura field connecting to the population to the community into the nation into the world, the ping pongs. I cannot put enough emphasis on the importance of maintaining balance in our daily activities, because you are an expression of your thoughts. Your body is an expression of what you put into it, whether it be the air you breathe, the food you eat, or the love you give and receive. Meditation is also recommended as part of a mental balance and toning, just as exercise is important for muscular toning. Now, cells are classified as plant or animal. Plants make their own food and are generally rigid, such as a tree, whereas man must seek his food, and thus his cells are more flexible. Because energy conforms to basic natural laws regarding shape, the size of the shape is only an indication of the power thus transmitted from one realm to another in the vicinity of the vortex. Now, the red blood cell, hemoglobin, is sickle-shaped when it's in static condition and nebular-shaped when it's in dynamic shape, or moving state. Hemoglobin's job is to transfer energy at the back end of the carbon cycle and to help maintain electrical life in the organism it serves. On a macro-shaped level, looking at the larger side of it, the Milky Way or the galaxy Andromeda are two bodies of greater energy, shaped the same as hemoglobin, transferring life's electrical energies into the vast body of the universe. Now, if you were to imagine, I'm sure you've all seen of the galaxy's Andromeda, and if you look at it, it looks like on its side, it looks like a kind of pattern. You can look at the hemoglobin is the same way when it's in rotation. It's like a cyclic action. It's kind of like a, you know, like a series of circles with the ends open and all connected into the center with a pyramid atom, of course, in the very beginning. In hemoglobin, you know, with the action of negative ions and oxygen, transports life into the body and picks up waste gases. Then the waste gases, carbon dioxide, are picked up by the chlorophyll in plants and converted back into oxygen in the plant leaves. So here's the hemoglobin creating something for the plants, and the plants creating something for the oxygen. This is one cycle. And of course, the cell cycle that switches back and forth in the body, in other words, the action of the red blood cell giving off carbon dioxide and picking up oxygen, has a frequency to it. It goes boom, boom, boom like that. That's the Bohr effect. Now, galaxies such as our Milky Way support the carbon cycle process and supply its light needs. In return, our actions feed the mental energies back via black holes, the source of creation, the influence, higher realms. And we're going to get into the higher realms. So let's look at the galaxies as supporting life, but there's a process in the supporting of life where energy is fed out of the galaxies into the higher realms. Another interesting cell I'd like to mention is the visible area. Now this is a very symbolic looking cell. It is considered a giant cell as far as cells in the algae forming family from tropical seas are concerned. It consists of a root-like holdfast and a long cylindrical stalk. At its sexual maturity, it turns into a cup-like cap. The nucleus is found in the holdfast as far away from the cap as possible. So, to give you an idea, just imagine when it's in sexual maturity, it's like the shape of a mushroom. The top of the mushroom opens up, and if you're looking at the mushroom coming out of the ground, you're standing directly over it, the shape of the top of it is acting like the galaxy. It would look like the galaxy. So this mushroom in the mushroom part, the cap part, you're looking down on it, the energy is moving it like the galaxy itself. Looking down the stem of the mushroom where it goes into the ground, the stem, by the way, it goes into the ground, it's called the holdfast. And in the holdfast is where the nucleus is. So the nucleus of the cell is at the base of it where it's hooked in the ground in this imaginary picture. And the energy part is at the very top. As it reaches its prophase stage of mitosis, division, the nucleus divides down in the bottom part, and the progeny of the pronuclei swim up into the cap, where they become the pronuclei of sex cells. They are released upon maturity to swim away in search of partners. So they swim up to the cap, the top, the mushroom, and swim away into the air. In this case, we're swimming away into the ocean, because they're inside the ocean. So they reproduce at the bottom. Just imagine as a mushroom now floating in the ocean. They're reproducing. I mean, they're sexually stimulated at the bottom, and then the pronuclei up the stalk into the cap, and where they're whirled off into space to reproduce other cells, to get other cells pregnant. Just as the acetabularia can be found in the salt water, so can a black hole be found in space. A black hole with a similar shape of the acetabularia called a space-time singularity. So you look at a black hole with a stem on it, the stem is called a space-time singularity. Its purpose is in the complete reverse of the acetabularia cell. Composed of a collapsing or spent star, it attracts matter and energy via its accelerating gravity into its bell-shaped intake and transmits this energy and matter into the fourth dimension of time and beyond through its long stem. Gradually, as the energies from a black hole neutralize themselves, the hole evaporates. So just imagine a cell, once again, in the ocean, like a mushroom floating in the ocean, its nucleus is at the stem, the very bottom. Energy moves up to the very top. At the very top, it leaves the top, goes out, and looks for the bottom of another cell to reproduce in. Black hole is just the opposite. It's another mushroom in space. Everything is coming in from the top, going down through the stem, and disappearing off into another dimension. And the dimension that it moves into eventually becomes consciousness. And this becomes the etheric and the physical levels, the astral, mental, and higher levels. The seven different dimensions are reached through the base of the space-time singularity until it finally evaporates. So this energy then, once it's evaporated, would go into space and time, would remanifest itself into the cell. So if you see this, start to see the cycle, this huge power down in the space-time singularity at the base, over to the base of a cell, the energy is suddenly manifesting at the base of a normal acetabularia cell, and it perpetuates its energy out of this form as intelligence, because it's converted into intelligence, into the cell, and it reproduces itself in the sea. And of course, these kinds of reproduce and create our atmosphere. In a lot of different algae, for example, like we were talking about spirulina, create our atmosphere. Our atmosphere, of course, is then oxygen. The oxygen is breathed in by man. Man gives off carbon dioxide, and it goes back into the cell, and it starts a feedback period there. So there's an actual feedback between black holes and space-time singularities and cells, if you start to get the bigger picture. The largest cell known is the ostrich egg, which contains a large quantity of yolk nourishment for the developing bird. The bird's egg, nor its shell, is counted as part of the cell because these structures are non-living materials secreted by the walls of the mother bird's oviduct. An average cell measures about 10 micrometers of 1/2500th of an inch in diameter. Now let's look at the shape, or think about the shape of a typical animal cell. In the center is the nucleus, whose functions have been already mentioned. And around this cell nucleus is a cellular membrane made of cytoplasm. Now remember, we talked about the nucleus of a cell. We went into the DNA. We showed you electrically how it all interacts and interworks at different vibratory frequencies, and how the antenna, the yogi antenna, is wound up in there. And this particular cell is connected to a particular antenna which has a series of frequencies. And then these sub-frequencies then operate depending on what determine whether it's a liver cell or it's whatever kind of cell it is, a thyroid cell. The parts of the cells that we would deal with are there's the lysosome, which is contains the digestive enzymes. Then there's the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER, which has nutrients through the cell. It's like the freeway system or the veins, the correspondent of our veins. Then we have the centrioles, which are down around or surrounding the nucleus itself. They have a function in mitosis. You have your cellular membrane itself, the cell wall itself, which of course the vitamin C and everything feeds into, which regulates the entrance and exits of material and energies. We have the cytoplasm. We have the nuclear membrane in the center. It's the nucleus. And then we have the little mitochondria located, which store the energy for the cell, the powerhouse of the cell. And then we have a thing called the Golgi apparatus, which is the package protein. In other words, it packages the protein for the cell. So the cell itself is like a smaller version of the human body. And if you start looking at which I laid out earlier, which is minerals, enzymes, vitamins, proteins, polypeptides, and then finally hormones, you start to see this is a cell is nothing more than a micro version of the whole chain of how the body works in the first place. Now let's look at the Earth a little bit and talk about that. Let's look at the Earth as a solar cell on a macro level. Okay, now, first of all, you have different belts around the surface of the Earth. We have the inner belts, which we just talked about. Now, let's look at the outer belts of the Earth. We talked about the two mantles and the crust and the molten inner core. Okay, on the outer, now we get out to the surface of the Earth. We end up, first of all, with the troposphere, which is right above the Earth. Okay, the troposphere. Then we go up to the mesosphere. Now, the mesosphere is the next layer of atmosphere above the Earth, and the ozone layer occurs at the lower level of the mesosphere, right above the troposphere. Okay, then we move up into the thermosphere, and then we go from the thermosphere to the exosphere, which is about 500 miles up, and then we go on out to the magnetosphere, which is the Van Allen radiation belt, which is further out yet. There's one area that's a little ways out called the ionosphere that is in between the thermosphere and the exosphere. It's out around 400 miles. If we were to look at the mileage of the metallic inner core of the Earth, it's estimated to be the core now of the Earth. It's about 800 miles across in diameter. and the lower mantle is approximately 2,600 across, or 1,300 miles on each side of the center, and the upper mantle is about 1,800 miles beyond the lower mantle on either side, 1,800 miles thick. And so then out there beyond that, you end up with the crust, which is about 5 miles thick. So you can begin to see a little bit about how the planet is put together. Now then, just for a little bit of review of these things, let's do a quick comparison. Let's look again at the cell to grasp the overall magnitude of the concept of life. I've found that if you study the basic components of each living thing in the game of life in relationship to these respective participants, then a general outline of the divine game begins to emerge. Next, look at the basic rules of motion and limitations of time. This, in turn, will begin to orchestrate itself through the subconscious mind, giving you a greater understanding of the basic flow and inner workings of all things. The most important thing, however, is that you begin to realize you're a part in the overall scheme of things. This is what Einstein called the general theory of relativity. The cell, like the Earth, has a core. Remember, I talked about it earlier. We call it the nuclear membrane. It has a core, which is called the nucleus. The nucleus is the actual center of the cell that's surrounded by the nuclear envelope, which is interpreted by a tunnel system called the endoplasmic reticulum. That's, remember, I talked about the highways. These tiny tunnels or pores permit a passage of molecules between the cytoplasm, which is the outer layer, and the nucleus. Within the nucleus are manufactured the genes from a substance called deoxyribonucleic acid in a specific linear order, which becomes the chromosome. And we went into detail on it. Remember how that was all taking place? The genes are chemically coded within the DNA and contain the intelligence to order the correct formation of the amino acids. We talked about that, which become protein. And these proteins form the balance of the cell itself. To further simplify the chromosome-gene relationship, think of the chromosomes as a chemical cookbook, and the genes as the individual recipes. In a man, each and every cell contains 46 chromosomes, identical. And we talked about that. Cell division, which is mitosis, takes place when the DNA duplicates itself and two complete sets of chromosomes are formed. But the vibration, the radar, how that works, the transformation, how the nuclear receptor helps that division take place correctly. And we talked about that, how the ELF equipment has a tendency to destroy that and cause the body to, the cells to combine with things that it shouldn't in confusion. If you want more information, see the cell chapter in the book that I wrote called Death of Ignorance. And all cells have organs, as I just said, and just as the body has organs to perfect, you know, component functions within the soul, within the whole, so does the cell. Now, a moment ago I talked about the magnetosphere as being the furthest out, going on out to the Van Allen radiation belt. I want you to draw a picture in your mind of the sun being on the left side, shining energy into space, and a little ways away from the sun is the Earth, with a positive charge around it. And this positive charge would be the magnetosphere containing the Van Allen radiation belt. And imagine that energy is moving from the sun into the Earth, and the backside of the Earth would be like where the shadow of the Earth would be extending out into space. It would be what we call the solar winds. And all the energy coming from the sun towards the Earth would also be solar wind. But where the solar wind would go around the Earth at a certain velocity and kind of maybe be deflected by the Earth and then come back together behind the Earth where the shadow would be, with that combination the solar wind takes place. Consider that independent time back there. That's where time has a tendency to change. It's very, very, go into different phenomena, different frequencies. Looking at the inner core and the outer core of the Earth has to go through changes when it goes through its evolution. And when it's evolving, there's two kinds of seismic waves that are released. We have the S wave, and you have the P wave. The S wave moves down from the surface of the Earth, down partially into the core of the Earth, and back up to the surface. The S wave, it bounces off the surface from the underneath part. In other words, imagine a big ball. Inside the ball is something moving around from going up to the edge of the ball and then falling back down towards the center and going up to the edge, falling back down. These are the S waves. The P waves, on the other hand, would go all the way down to the center and come all the way back up. They'd be more direct, more penetrating. The S waves are lateral and they bounce around, where the P waves are straight. They almost go straight, like a FM type signal. And they pass through liquids, where the S waves will bounce off of them. That's why S waves will bounce around off the bottom of the oceans. Now, if you realize that also the Earth has a metal core, this maintains a temperature of 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is in constant opposite of the surface motion or rotation. This counter rotation sets up a delicate frictional barrier that helps produce the Earth's magnetic field. Outside the core is a mantle, and this is semi-solid, is 1,800 miles thick, composed of heavy silicate rock, which is brought to the surface by a volcanic. Now, looking at the way that this Earth is producing this counter-rotating, if the Earth is moving in the air, I mean in outer space, it's moving from the west to the east, or then we'll be moving from the east to the west, the opposite. Producing a magnetic field. Then realize the magnetic field is also present around the human being as part of the aura. And by mutual induction, meaning attraction and repulsion, that energy is increased or influenced by the Earth's magnetic field. So at night when you go to sleep, for example, you're charging off the Earth's magnetic field. At the same time, if you're discharging a lot of negative energy into the Earth's magnetic field, it's going to be affected. And if the effect is too great, it's going to put stress on the Earth. And then, of course, the Earth's magnetic field interacts with the different magnetic fields of the other heavenly bodies in the solar system. And what happens is, after a while, if the Earth's magnetic field gets too negative because of too much negative on there, and we talked about the evolution of how people's energies work, you know, one person, a single individual, the personality, becomes the personality of a town, you know, a city, and then into a nation and the whole world. And this energy gets too negative, what happens is it creates a friction which upsets these P waves and these S waves, which then causes an earthquake. So man can control earthquakes if he learns how that they're created in the first place. Most of the Earth's uranium, thorium, and potassium are in the outer crust, but the mantle does radioactive elements. As the Earth gives off heat to space, convection currents from the central hot core are set in motion via the volcanic action, and herein lies a delicate balance that man has begun to interfere with. On a similar level, man has begun to interfere with cellular growth by introducing many toxic imbalances. Now, you may ask yourself, just where did we go astray and interfere with the delicate balance of nature? Was it 100 years ago or when? Let's just trace back our history for a few seconds and build your own, you know, come to your own conclusions. 5 billion years ago, the Earth's original atmosphere was probably composed of compounds such as water and ammonia, and the carbon-containing substance called methane. Today, Jupiter has a similar atmosphere because it is further away from the Sun. Eventually, however, scientists believe that as the Sun ages and becomes much hotter, Jupiter will receive only 1/27 the amount of sun as the Earth, and it will begin to have a similar atmosphere as the Earth, and of course, by then, the Earth's atmosphere will have changed again also. I make this statement only to show that there is a constant growth within the solar system as well as our own personal environments. Now, I know Semyasi had told me that if we destroyed the Earth, we went out in the astral bodies, we'd have to wait for another Earth-like incarnation cycle to begin. We need another Earth condition to come back and finish up our racial karma. And that's therefore the people that weren't free of the solar karma, the solar system, couldn't evolve beyond the ring pass knot of our solar system. We'd be stuck in astral plane limbo until a habitable planet would be made possible. And she had pointed out that Jupiter would be the next planet. We'd have to wait many, many millions of years before we could come back and incarnate here. What then would be the Earth to work out physical plane type conditions so that we could be free of that lower karma to move off into other dimensions, other times, and other spaces. In 1952, Stanley Miller, a graduate chemist, constructed an early hypothetical atmosphere of water vapor, hydrogen, ammonia, and methane. He then exposed this to a lightning bolt of 60,000 volts. The gases had been arranged within a sealed flask and electricity discharge causing a participation of water at the bottom. After a week of exposure, the condensed water in the bottom was found to contain the four basic amino acids found in DNA. Adenine, thiamine, guanine, and cytosine. This action is called by science spontaneous generation. Now, we talked about that, remember, in the last few hours back on the other tape, we got into the DNA in the cell, which we were talking about, the phosphates and the sugars. As the Earth begins to evolve further, the surface temperature begins to drop. Vast electrical storms rampage the gaseous atmosphere, bringing about a condensation of some 200 million billion tons of water above the planet's surface. That's about a tenth of today's water. Yet no oceans existed yet. Planet Venus is in a similar situation today, with most of her water still suspended in a vaporous state above her surface. During this post-deluge period, the skies were probably a vivid greenish blue when the rains began to come and lasted for 1 million years after that. So a whole 1 million years of raining. During this period and continuing, the Earth is and was constantly reversing its polarity. This means that instead of the top of the compass needle pointing to the north as it does now, it would have pointed to the south. The Earth is part of its normal cycle, reverses polarity every 400,000 years, which accounts for the vast electrical changes. You can look at the Earth cycling back and forth with its polarity, north and south, north and south, just like the brain does when it's switching electrical energy, just like when I showed you earlier with the long wire, where we had a piece of wire, we had a positive terminal and negative terminal on battery, and we switched it positive, negative, like that. The Earth has switched polarity at least 10 times in the last 4 million years, with this cycle, and this cycle has repeated itself at least for 72 million years. The Earth's poles shift geographically and magnetically, usually a few inches a year, going back to 700 million BC, when the North Pole was now in Arizona, then a pre-Cambrian sea. As the Earth's magnetic field literally rolls through space end over end as it moves in complete harmony with the Sun's magnetic fields, the area in space where the two interact is called the magnetosphere. The fact that Earth is a superorganism or a supercell should rapidly be becoming more apparent as evolution unfolds even further. As the internal motions continued, the semi-solid and the outer motions, gaseous and plasmic, reacted during the rain periods, the surface was covered with 300 million cubic miles of water, 300 cubic miles of which evaporate every day to rain and circulate planet-wide. Every 3,000 years, every drop of water in the seas has recirculated through the atmosphere and land every 2 million years. All of the water on Earth, through photosynthesis, circulates through all animal and vegetable cells. Oxygen that is not bound up in water completes its cycle through our bodies and through plants in 2,000 years. Carbon dioxide takes only 300 years to circulate, and that is progressively decreasing as man's lungs, chimneys, and exhaust pour more and more forth each year. This is really, really bad, isn't it? Evolution continued as lakes formed through the separation in the land, minerals, and the oceans. Then came in proteins in the still lake bottoms and the long chains of molecules. With this, of course, came the enzymes to speed up chemical actions and flat molecules to yield heme, red blood cell pigment, and green plant pigment, chlorophyll. And realize also that the oxygen, when you start looking at spirulina, spirulina also has a similar constituent as to our blood. Then photosynthesis became a large-scale phenomenon, increasing the consumption of carbon dioxide, and so plants began to surface everywhere. Millions of tons of oxygen, a byproduct of photosynthesis, was poisoning the air. Look at that, oxygen is poisoning the air. In a few thousand more years, the air was about 20% oxygen, which it is today. Well, I say it is today, it really isn't anymore. It's down to about 18% again. Soon, of course, new oxygen-dependent cells were formed, animal cells, of course, and the great carbon cycle began to come into balance. Then came the specialization of cells, the various ages of large animals, the Pleistocene era, and then finally man. And, of course, man was then, the man that evolved here was then super impregnated with outer space people, and superhumans started to come along and evolve, coming back and forth on the planets. Now we're just getting the beginning picture. Now let me just give you a couple of examples where we went wrong with this beautiful grand scheme of things. As the overall consciousness of man began to evolve in the machine age in the late 1800s, a source of energy was needed to propel these machines. Wood and coal were the first source man sought, as it was readily available. I realize that this is only one cycle. As we go around the Pleiades every 27,827.5 years, there have been many times the human race has evolved and then fallen down, evolved and fallen down. In all of these times, when the free energy sources were used, we did not use fossil fuels. But as more and more of our society became dependent on the sources of energy, great entrepreneurs such as J. Pierpont Morgan and the Rockefellers quickly moved in on the scene and began to control industry from all levels. Atmospheric pollution was in fact a problem at the turn of the century, as the Londoners coined the term smog, smoke and fog. Quite interesting. A lot of people didn't realize that how long smog has been around. Great inventors and masterminds of the day were still alive during this period. Men such as Nikola Tesla, Michael Faraday, Gustav Eiffel, who was a great inventor, built the Eiffel Tower, Albert Einstein, Voltaire, and others. Being men of great visions, they set about, saw the impending doom, especially Tesla. I mean, when you talk about screaming about what was coming, they saw the impending doom of the byproducts of their progeny and immediately set about to develop alternative forms of energy sources, including free energy, solar power, and advanced wind machines.
This seminar series is continued on the next tape.
Okay, now we're going to go up to the next one. Boy, what fun we're having here today. Sorry for the cutting out. This tape series isn't going to be like this. There's just a few of them that are doing this. And like I say, it's 1991, but the stuff is pretty advanced for then. And a lot of it is just now coming to light in the scientific community. So we'll just continue right on here for the next few more minutes, and then we'll be seeing you live tomorrow night, February 10th, 2007. Just waiting for this puppy to come on here. Are you? Where's Dr. Bell? We lost him. There he comes.
Suppressed, however, by the establishment of cartels who, through large banking agencies such as Chase Manhattan, the Rockefeller family, controlled all the development monies needed to further the progress into new realms. And of course, you got to remember the classic argument that took place between Nikola Tesla and J. Pierpont Morgan back in the late 30s. He says, "Look, we want to come up. I have a development now with free energy here." And all people have to do is use an antenna in their house, and they can receive energy from a master power station, and they won't have to generate all this fossil fuel electricity, because we can use the Earth's magnetic field with ERG equipment, Earth Resonant Generators. J. Pierpont Morgan said, no, we don't want to do that, because we can't charge for it. Once we have the initial installation, we're out of business. And, of course, you know the rest. The next thing that happened, you know, is our cells, unable to breathe properly, starved for nutrients and full of poisons, began to generally mutate genetically in the wrong direction, creating a whole new host of diseases for the human body. This, of course, gave birth to another cartel, which we call the Physicians and Drug Administration of hard drugs to cover up symptoms of the increasing environmental toxicity produced a mental stress factor which sent people everywhere looking for a quick relief, a quick way out, and thus giving birth to the mass practice of psychiatry and psychology. A great number of cults began to appear as street drug users began their protest to sociological pressure. Let's look at this. Let's just take a quick look at the air pollution on a grand karmic scale. Millions of years ago, during the Pleistocene Age, the surface temperature of the Earth was much higher than it is today, so that life forms had reached gigantic proportions. Dinosaurs and heavy vegetation were everywhere. The vegetation was huge in those days. Plants were, one leaf was half the size of a house. But at that time, the Earth's surface was quite unstable, as there was no inner shock absorbers built into the lower levels of the Earth's crust. The core and the mantle layers of the planet were very active, as if life itself were needed to be a damper between the core and the surface. So nature, knowing that man was on the way, began to prepare the Earth's surface. Everywhere there began earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, and the entire surface was transferred deep into the interior. Now subject to great pressure, animal life and plant life decayed and formed massive crude oil deposits deep below which became a perfect shock absorber for the surface. Even an automobile rides better with shock absorbers, which of course are filled with oil. Now, if you think that, well, then of course the next thing that happened, man came along and drained the oil from the earth. Now, look, realize that the earlier races during this earthquake time were nomadic, like the Arabs. They had to move around. The consciousness couldn't evolve when you're always on the run. You got to sit still and meditate and contemplate on where you are and who you are. And of course, the earlier races couldn't do that because they were in constant turmoil from that massive earthquakes. However, began to notice that the land became unstable around oil fields, and suggestions were made to replace the oil cavities with water. A very poor choice, I should say. Try replacing the oil in your car with water and see what happens. I mean, how long will the engine run? How comfortable will the shock absorbers be? The cork of the dilemma is that this dinosaur death was removed from its grave in the earth by mechanical means in the name of progress and spread and dissipated into our precious atmosphere. I'm not against progress, but blind progress in the face of facts is what I call greed. The oxygen carbon cycle of plants and man calls not for fossil fuel as a means to an end. And I just want you to be aware of these things. And then, of course, the smog tragedy started to happen. The first ones that they had, 1948, there was one in Denora, Pennsylvania. 14,000 people, 6,000 people got sick from the atmosphere. The worst one being in Meuse River Valley, Belgium, which in 1930, thousands of people got sick, 60 people died from poison air, and this is the beginning of smog. And then, of course, it started raining, and when it rains down to the water supplies, and then pretty soon, you know, over in Japan, they started putting oxygen masks on the street corners, and on and on and on and on. So you begin to see what was happening here. You know, it's really sad. Well, I'm on this subject, I just want to talk about the ozone layer briefly for a second here. The top of the top troposphere, we talked about that earlier, is called the tropopause, and above it is a relatively still zone called the mesosphere. Convection currents rarely rise into it, so it gets small amounts of heat from the below and contains little water vapor. Remember that the Earth is heated by the greenhouse effect, and this, of course, is where the Earth's sun's rays reflect from the surface. They come in from the sun, they're reflected off the surface, and then they're trapped in our atmosphere. And then, of course, when the traps, we extract the heat from them. The mesosphere is an important constituent. Is a small amount of ozone in an active form of oxygen whose molecules, and it's written as O3, are made up of ordinary oxygen, which is written as O2, that have been broken up by ultraviolet light. Ozone is violently poisonous, but in the mesosphere it is very beneficial for the Earth's life. It strongly absorbs a kind of ultraviolet radiation that would kill, would just basically, like getting in a microwave if we didn't have it, would kill all of its Earth contemporary organisms if unprotected by destroying the vital nucleic acids in the cells. Remember, we talked about the 12 billion nucleonic acids in the cell. The ultraviolet just cooks those little guys right up. Ozone is only found in trace amounts in the mesosphere, equivalent to 1/100,000th of an inch of surface pressure, but without it, all life on Earth would die as we would know it. And of course, we've already talked about the destruction of the ozone layer from high flying jet aircraft, and how the establishment is trying to say, hey, you know, we want to, you know, we get rid of refrigeration and all this kind of stuff and change the chemicals there. But that's not the problem at all. The problem is the high flying jet aircraft, and that's a major cartel. Remember, we talked about cartels just a minute ago. See the problems. So now, in summation of where this last little topic we've been about, is that basically what we've said is most of the external physical factors which have been implicated in the evolution of life are of the electromagnetic nature. It has now been established, as I pointed out earlier, that throughout the renewable geological period, the biosphere has been a region of electromagnetic fields and radiations of all frequencies known to us. From slow periodic variations of the Earth's magnetic field and electric fields to gamma rays. It is fundamentally possible, I have found, on the basis of general considerations, that any of the magnetic spectrum could have played some role in the evolution of life, and are involved in the vital processes of organisms. This has been demonstrated, of course, for a considerable region of the spectrum, for electromagnetic radiations in the infrared to ultraviolet range, which is photobiology, from X-rays, and from X-rays, which is radiobiology. The situation is different for the vast region remaining of the spectrum, which includes electromagnetic fields of super high, ultra high, high, and infra low frequencies. And as I pointed out, some definite examples back a little while ago, especially with the book on the ELF book, experimental investigations and theoretical considerations suggest that these fields have a significant biological action, and I emphasize significant. When their intensity is fairly high, such action can be due to only one process, conversion of electromagnetic energy to heat or vice versa, because realize when electromagnetic energy hits the body, it starts to heat the body up in different areas internally, and of course chemical reaction does respond to heat. There is an increasing amount of experimental data that indicates electromagnetic fields can have non-thermal effects, and that living organisms of diverse species from the unicellular organisms of man are extremely electromagnetic fields. It has also been found that very weak natural electromagnetic fields can affect the organisms of various species. All this indicates necessity for a fundamentally new approach to the problem we've got to look at now. In the last century, Baron von Rickenhoff in Germany conducted immense research on the effects of the applied fields to amplify currents across dissimilar surfaces. Later in the century, his work was followed up by Wilhelm Reich and Townsend Brown. At the turn of the century, Michael Faraday did work on isolating organisms in their respective fields. His work was followed by Nikola Tesla, and by 1940s, Thomas Colson and Fred Hart, and they, by the way, were the founders of the National Health Federation, had built a device that brought about almost instantaneous healing of certain ailments of the human body. They primarily were working with, at that time, arthritis and a 44 megahertz infrared device. We're going to talk about that more when we get down to the X1 healing machine. This was the roots of the X1, which we'll get into later on.
And this is a good place to end the show. And we'll see you tomorrow night. And thanks for making us the voice of Tampa Bay, all you people down there at Tantalk1340.com. And we'll talk to you tomorrow night. Bye.